do you ever meet somebody and you're just like, man, I just want to know more about you? Well, Barbara Given is one of those people. Barb runs a gelato shop in Jackson Ward. I think she turns 82 this year, but she's still like legitimately working at the store. She's making schedules. She scoops ice cream. She rings people up. And when you walk into the store, there's an old black and white picture of a young girl standing in front of an ice cream shop. And it's a picture of Barb from a job she had as a girl.
That's me standing in front of the ice cream bowl where I was working when I was 15. I had painted these Walt Disney characters on the windows. And you see, 29 cents for a banana split and 26 cents for an ice cream bowl.
Barb started Stoplight Gelato with her son, Bryce. He passed away from cancer in 2015 at the age of 52. And a picture of Bryce as a young man hangs there on the wall. It's a shot of him probably in his early 20s. Leather jacket, leaning against an iron pole. And there's a big stoplight that hangs from the ceiling that Bryce got from a friend right around the time that he and his mom, Barb, were trying to name the place.
He got that and he called me and he said, Mom, what would you think about calling our place Stoplight Gelato Cafe? I said, that's it. Let's do it.
Now, Barb lives above the shop and she was kind enough to invite us up to hang out with her and, you know, just talk about her life. It's this super cool loft apartment, you know, open floor plan, exposed wooden floors, and windows that look out over the street. And she lives there with her dog, Lola, and her cat, Michael Jackson. Yes, the cat's name is Michael Jackson. Hey there, I'm Blaine Lay, and you're listening to Two People. Today on the show, I sit down with Barbara Given, owner of Stoplight Gelato. She's lived some life, and she tells us all about it. From growing up in Kansas as the youngest of five in a railroad family, to talking about what it was like pursuing higher ed as a woman and her 30-year career in education at George Mason. She even reflects some on the life that she's lived and how she thinks about the end of life.
Okay, now you ready for this story? I'm going to tell it the truth. This is the best I can.
This is episode 28 with Barbara Given.
Some people call me Miss Barbara here in the South, but most people just call me Barb.
You're listening to Two People. Great. Well, Barb, thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure.
So glad you're here. Thank you for welcoming us into your apartment. We're sitting in a beautiful, hip loft, looking out the window to Gallery 5 here, right above the gelato shop. So thank you so much. I wanted to start at the beginning. I know that you're from Kansas. Could you just tell me a little bit about your childhood and what it was like growing up in Kansas?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm the youngest of five, and so my sister's the oldest. And she's 10 years older than me, so we had three brothers in between. And as the youngest, I probably got babied more than anybody else. And being a girl after three boys, I think that made some difference, too. But basically, my parents were very hardworking, blue-collar workers, and I was born in a little town called Quinimo, an Indian name. And when I was just before I started to school, we moved to another little community called Neosho Rapids, which is the name of the river. And there's where I started to school. And we lived for that, I think, probably 2 years, year and a half maybe, in a railroad car. Because my dad was a railroader.
Oh, wow.
And at that time, they had these long yellow passenger cars that were kind of rounded at both ends. And the railroad company removed many of them that had gone, you know, needed to be replaced, and put them along the railroad tracks for families, railroad families, to live in. And so we lived in one, and then we had a second one for storage and that sort of thing. And it was kind of a fun place to live because you would go in one end, and that was the kitchen, and we had no refrigeration or electricity. Mm-hmm. So we had a little box, like an orange crate, that was hung out at one of the windows for keeping food cold during the winter. And
how did you stay warm in the winter when you were staying in the railroad car?
I just don't know how we did that. I think we had, as I recall, we had like a little potbelly stove at one place in the long, because when you go in the kitchen and there were five of us, and with my parents, of course, seven. And so you go in one bedroom after the other, and at the far end was the living room.
Right.
And you go out the living room door, and you walk I don't know how many feet to the outhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a big garden.
Right.
So that was a unique experience, and we lived, of course, right by the railroad tracks. So.
And you said you were one of five.
Right.
Three older brothers?
Three older brothers.
Did you have any sisters?
My sister was the oldest, and she was 10 years old.
Ah, okay. And you were the youngest. Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Okay. And did you get along with your brothers and sisters, with your folks?
My oldest brother and my sister were from a previous marriage of my mother's, and they sort of had they were kind of rebellious, and they were constantly in trouble with juvenile delinquency issues, my brother especially. And my sister and her girlfriend would decide to run away from home from time to time.
Right.
And so we had those issues once. My oldest brother was gone my parents had absolutely no idea where he was. And we went to a local carnival and sideshows and that sort of thing. And there he was with a boa constrictor wrapped around his neck. And my mother says, "Jim!" and so she went backstage and persuading him to come home.
Did she get him to come home?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Did he bring the snake?
No snake.
You can come home, but you can't bring the snake.
Right.
That's great. One of your early jobs, you worked at an ice cream shop before you opened one here. Can you tell me about some of your early jobs?
Well, that, of course, was after we moved to several different communities in Kansas, and then we ended up in Manhattan.
And did your dad's job take you around to different places?
Yes. But then he was a signal maintainer, which means he rode one of those little putt-putt cars and checked all the signals. Something happened to one of the signals that it malfunctioned, and all of a sudden he said he heard this whistle behind him and looked around, and a train was barreling down on him, so he jumped and saved his life. But his putt-putt was demolished, and as the railroad policy was, is that if you're ever in an accident, you're laid off for a certain period of time. Well, we were living from paycheck to paycheck for food and so on. So that's when my mother says, "Well, we'll just have to move." And so that's what we did. And we moved to where my grandparents lived in Manhattan.
Okay.
And that's where I, as a high school student, worked at the ice cream bowl. And then later at the soda shop.
Okay. And what was it like working at the ice cream bowl?
Well, it was really interesting because it was during segregation, of course, at that time. And I had friends at school who were black, and they'd come in for ice cream. And if the manager wasn't there, I'd treat them like I'd treat anybody else. Mm-hmm. If she was there, she would insist that they go down to the end of the counter, and then she would just treat them absolutely atrociously. And it just embarrassed me and made me feel sad, you know. But when she wasn't there, I treated them like royalty.
And this would have been, what, late 40s, early 50s?
Okay. It was 50, 51.
Okay.
50 and 51.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Huh. You studied education. Like, you spent a lot of your career in education.
Right.
And did you go to Kansas State for your undergraduate?
Well, first I went to Colorado Women's College in Denver for 2 years, and then I transferred to K-State.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And what was it like during that era? Was it unique as a woman going to college, or was it something that everyone did?
Well, let me just tell you a couple of examples. After college, in applying for positions at the university, or first of all at public schools, but after I taught in the public schools and then applied after I finished my PhD.
And what would this have been? Was this in the 50s, 60s?
Yeah, well, in the fall of 1974, I started the special education teacher preparation program at George Mason. But here's the kicker, is that when I applied, the dean said, well, Do you know what universities graduate people with a specialty in special education? And I said, well, I named a few. And he says, well, we really want a man for this position, so we'll check those universities out. If we can't find one, we'll get back to you. Mm-hmm. And so they were offering $18,000 a year, and no man would take it at that price, and I did.
Right.
And so they let me have the title of acting coordinator of special education. But before the end of the semester, the board of directors, which surprised me greatly, but the board of directors told our president that that they should take off the acting because the role that I had and the results that we were getting from youngsters, because my students worked directly with youngsters under my supervision, mm-hmm. They're getting really good results. And so that spread in the community. And so they asked me to ask the president to take the acting off my title.
And so this is early 1974. Mm-hmm. What was that like for you when you heard that?
Well, the second part of that story is planning the curriculum for the whole new program, because mm-hmm. 94-142 had just been passed, and so teacher training was for teachers to work with children with learning disabilities was especially critical. And I said to the current dean, I said, you know, it's really foolish to have three different courses, that full three credit courses, one in history, one in psychology, and one in whatever, philosophy. I said, you could put all of that together as far as teachers are concerned and get on with the business of teaching them how to teach and not all the theory. So he said, well, it's a good idea. Let's go talk with the director of education down in Richmond. So we came down here, and I explained what I thought we should put in place of these three courses. And the director at that time, little short bald-headed guy, no offense intended.
Yeah, no, none taken.
and he says to me, well, little lady, boy, I was just struggling to keep my composure. Well, little lady, when you get to be as old as I am, or when you get to be more seasoned, you'll understand that things just don't happen that way. Mm. and I kept my composure, but boy, I just wanted to sock the guy.
Yeah.
Well, little lady.
So. Wow. Yeah, I mean, those are remarkable stories. I think certainly my generation, we've got some gaps to close, but it's interesting and also heartbreaking to hear some of those stories of just the how patronized you must have felt in that moment.
I did feel very patronized.
And I think particularly when from what I understand, a lot of the research that you've done and your approach to teaching, just from what I've read, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that teaching isn't just a cognitive download of learn these facts,
no.
But it's about how do you create an environment in the classroom.
Absolutely.
That where a child can learn socially, emotionally, and this era of time that you're talking about in the early 70s is when a lot of the neuroscience research was coming out,
right.
Which is totally fascinating that here you've got this great idea, you're actually on the cutting edge, but you've got someone that's being fairly patronizing when mm-hmm. this is actually the direction that a lot of these things are going. Could you just talk a little bit about kind of your bread and butter inside of education? I know that you spent decades studying and teaching, but could you just talk a little bit about that approach to education that you were championing?
Well, I think that, of course, we're all products of our rearing. And I grew up not being able to read until I was an adolescent. And I really struggled because reading, it was like magic. My brothers and my sister were very avid readers. And I loved listening to stories, but I just couldn't decipher the words.
Right.
And I'll just tell you a quick little anecdote about that. Is when I was in the first or second grade, I don't remember which, Miss Street was our teacher, and at that time in this little community, the kindergarten, first, second, third, and fourth grade were in the same class, so few children. And I recalled Miss Street wrote on the board the letters A-E-I-O-U, and I went home that night, and I said, and my mom was the cook at the school, and I told, and they were always joking around with each other, and I told Mom, I said, guess what, Miss Street told us a joke today. And Mom said, well, what was it? And I said, she wrote all these different letters on the board, and they all had the same sound. Is that funny? And my mom, cooking dinner, says, yeah, that's funny, and went on cooking dinner.
Wow.
But the point is, I could not hear the differences in the sounds. And when I was in the ninth grade, I decided I've had enough of this business of not being able to read. So I took my babysitting money and went to the bookstore and bought a book. I still have it. It's called You Can Teach Your Child to Read. And so I spent most of that summer on the front porch trying to figure out how to teach myself to read. Hmm. And I loved that book. I guess that's why I still have it. Because there were the Oi Boys. Oi Boys, O-I and O-Y, Oi Boys, you mean that they have a sound all of their own, Oi Boys? I thought, man, this is great. And then, and then there were the Ur Sisters, I-R-E-R and U-R. I said, wow, they all say like Ur, so if I see those, I'll always say Ur. And so I just started working through this book. And the reason I liked it is because there were pictures of the Ur Sisters and the Oi Boys, and so I could visualize it.
And you're tearing up a little bit.
I know, because it's so emotional to me.
Yeah.
And
what did that unlock for you?
A world.
Yeah.
A whole world. I finally read my first book that summer. It was called Hot Rod. And as you can tell by the title, it was just consonant, vowel, consonant mm-hmm. words, except for one word, which was ambulance. And it was... And I read the whole thing. And I was so proud of myself. This is so funny. I went back to school just filled with anticipation of the excitement that I could write something on this sheet. Because mm-hmm. every year school started, we all had to write down all the books we'd read that summer. And I could write down Hot Rod and I could spell it.
Right. To what extent did that experience of struggling with literacy and then learning how to read, and then you went into education. That's what shaped your passion for it?
Mm-hmm. Because I knew that if I learned how to read as an adolescent, that the kids who were struggling like I did could learn how to read if the teachers taught them the way they learned.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the highlights for you at George Mason? Because did you start a reading program to teach?
I did. We started a program called the Child and Youth Study Center.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where parents would bring their children who were struggling. And my graduate students would teach them. And we had one-way mirrors, observation rooms, where the teachers would work with the youngsters and I could observe and make notes and give feedback to the teachers. And if they were really off tack, I could just go in and get them back on track.
Right.
And sometimes they were really off track and they didn't realize they were off track. And so I just needed to stop them right then and there.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
You've lived a lot of life. And this is all before the gelato shop.
Oh, yes.
So I want to ask you a little bit about Stoplight Gelato, which we're sitting right above right now. You started it with your son, who is no longer with us, Bryce.
Well, that's not quite true.
Okay.
We bought the building together, and we started renovating it together. But we didn't really know what we were going to do.
So you got the building first.
Yes. Okay. We didn't really know what we were going to do, and so we investigated coffee shops, donut shops, chili and hot dog shops, and different mm-hmm. things. And I was so surprised to find that when my son passed away, he had made several different binders of things that on each of those topics, because he was really trying to figure out, well, what do we do? Because I said, honey, I can't keep financing this project. You're going to have to earn some money. And so he said, that's when he started figuring out, well, what would he like to do most? And then he said, one day, he said, "Mom, you remember that picture in your scrapbook of you at the ice cream bowl?" He says, "Why don't we do that?" Hmm. And so I said, good, I'd like to do that. So that's how that got started.
Gotcha.
But that was the reason we bought the building. Didn't have anything to do with gelato.
Okay.
It had to do with that big back room downstairs.
Okay.
That is big enough to house six vehicles.
Because he was kind of he needed a workshop. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Okay. He wanted to have a place to work on his Volkswagens out of the cold and out of the heat. And so that's why we bought the building. That's why the cafe is so small.
Yeah, right. And was he always like that? Well, I mean, tell me a little bit about Bryce and just what he was like as a child and what was your relationship.
Well, he was always tinkering. He was always bringing home parts of bicycles that he'd find in the junk in the alleyway, not alleys, but on the street. He would bring home things. I mean, he was a real collector. And so he just found fascination in everything and interest in everything. But mostly he liked tinkering with things. And the interesting thing of it is he'd collect all these bicycle parts and then build these bicycles, but he'd always leave off something. He'd always leave off a pedal or a handlebar grip or something. And I'd say, why don't you go ahead and finish? And he said, no, I don't want it. Finish it. And so it was like, so long as he didn't finish it, it was still a work in progress.
Right. And it's almost like he enjoyed the process more than getting to the end. Was he your only child?
No, I have a daughter. And interestingly, she's here in town right now. She and her husband live in Delaware. And she came and visited after she saw what a turmoil her dad went through after Bryce passed away, and he was the executor of Bryce's estate. And she was afraid that I'd pass away and she'd be left not knowing what to do. So she called me one day and she said, "Mom, what if you die?" I said, "Well, I'm going to die." She says, "Yeah, but I won't know what to do. What am I going to do?" I said, "Well, honey, I have all the paperwork all done." She says, "But I don't know where it is. Honey, I sent it to you." Hmm. "Yeah, but I don't know what to do." I said, "Come, I'll introduce you to all the critical people you need to know, and they'll help you figure out what to do." So she came on a Thursday. We went to see 1776 and the play, and Friday she met all the people. Friday night she helped me scoop my gelato and worked in the cafe, and she realized for the first time that this was lots of fun and that it was enjoyable. So she went home Saturday morning. Sunday she called and she says, "Mom, Joe and I have been looking online. We found a little house at Forest Hill Avenue." And the short of it is, she said, "Would you go look at it?" So I did, and I reported back. They came the following Saturday, met with the realtor, made an offer. The offer was accepted. And they bought the house.
Wow.
They're moving in some of their stuff today.
Today? Mm-hmm. Wow.
And so she's gonna help me run the cafe.
Oh. Mm-hmm. That's got to be so exciting for you as a mother. You'll have a partner in crime and they'll be close by.
Absolutely.
Wow. That's so great. Mm-hmm. And was Bryce diagnosed in 2014?
He had cancer about 13 years before. And he had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. He had stem cell transplant, and it seemed to do the trick. Now, his doctor said he was cured. Bryce took that to the bank, his mental bank, and believed it whole, hook, line, and sinker, "I'm cured," which meant to him he wasn't going to get cancer again. And it didn't even enter his head that he'd get cancer again. And so when he got this big knot in his stomach, he thought he needed to go get a colonoscopy because he said, "I'm after all 52, I better go get a colonoscopy." And of course, the doctor sent him right back to the oncologist. And so he had these two very aggressive types of cancer. And the doctors really didn't know what to treat, which to treat first and how to treat the two together. And nice people, those doctors, but I don't have a lot of warmth and good feelings because I felt that they were using rice sort of as an experiment to see which drugs might work. And they made, by their own admission, they made one mistake by giving him too much of the wrong medicine. And then the other time, was something similar. And as soon as, I mean, he was walking and you know, still coming up the stairs and all, he had all this chemo. And the very next day, he had to be in a wheelchair.
Oh, wow. Because you had this, I mean, you had purchased the building with him. You were working on the gelato shop. After his passing, did you ever think about, could you have sold the building? Did you go on, you know?
Well, I really didn't know what to do because the building was not in a saleable condition. But I did have a realtor come in, and he essentially told me the same thing. I said, well, should I stay here? I like my little condo. I bought my little condo as my dying home, and I like living in Old Town. I don't know that I'd like living in Richmond. And then all of a sudden it dawned on me, why are you debating this? You don't have an option. You get your butt down there and get that building finished. So that's what I decided to do.
And what's that been like? Because it sounds like, you know, this is something you and Bryce were working on to sort of take the baton to bring that to life. Like, what has that been like for you?
Well, it was really, really hard for the first year and a half, especially the first year. And as I said, some of his carpenter friends helped me the first few months. And they left before they finished all they promised Bryce that they'd do. They said, we just can't do this.
You've got a, when you walk into your apartment, you look up and kind of on the front of the loft, there's a wall of beer cans, but really beautiful bookshelves. And it sounds like some of his friends actually helped bring that to life. I'm wondering how much the woodworking and moving to a new place, like how much did actually bringing Stoplight Gelato to life help you in the process of mourning?
It did. It helped a lot. I cried all the time. And that's why his friends couldn't stay. It was too hard for them. They said, we miss Bryce too much. We can't do this work.
Yeah. Wow. I know a lot of the neighbors have pitched in here to help you out. What has that meant to you? Like, how do you think about community and being a neighbor? Because it sounds like this place would not have come to life without their support.
Oh, that's exactly right. And, I mean, they are so caring. Just this Terry, the neighbor across the alley, saw me leaving at 9:30, 9:45 the other night. Because he monitors me, he made a promise to Bryce that he'd keep his eye on me. And sometimes he keeps too much of his eye on me. So I'm getting in the car, and this older woman, not as old as me, but she's a panhandler, but I didn't know that at the time. And I just knew she was cold, and it was that really cold night. She was cold, and she was hungry, and I gave her food, and I gave her some money, and I said I'd take her to her car because she said she'd run out of gas, or I'd take her wherever she wanted to take her. And he saw me. He says, where are you going and who's that with you? And I explained to him, and he says, well, it's after 9:30. I said, Terry, I got it. And then just yesterday morning he says, why is your car window down? I said, I didn't know it was. He said, well, it's been down all morning. I said, okay, I'll go take care of it. So I'm telling you that he's really watches out after me.
I think it's a beautiful picture of dependence on your part. But I think there's a mutuality that happens too. I mean, when you go into the store, there's an energy that I think you are giving something back to a lot of these people that come through your doors. Do you have any sense of what?
Oh, yes. Now, some of the young people who came to help, and they didn't know the first thing about anything, woodworking, painting, anything. And most of them had never used any power tools. And so I really was very guarded because the last thing I wanted was somebody to be having an accident with a power tool.
Right.
So I would watch them and teach them how to use the power tools and so on. And they got pretty good. And I'm going to tell you about Alex. He lives just right down there, two doors down. Alex was a pre-dental student. And he came and he says, I'd like to help you. And one day he called me. He says, Barb, I have 2 hours. You have something you want me to do? I said, Alex, I always have something to do. So he came and I tried to give him several different options. And I listed 5 things. And he said, well, I think I'd like to trim a door. I said, trim a door? Okay. Have you ever trimmed a door before? No. Have you ever had any woodworking experience? Yes, I have. Well, tell me about it. I took shop in 7th grade. I says, Alex, you'll do beautifully. Okay, there's a door back here, and it's the one we walk through to come up the stairs. And I says, this is the door that needs to be trimmed. Okay, did you use power tools in the 7th grade? He says, yes, but I haven't used them since, and they weren't quite like this kind of thing. I says, well, let's go for it. So I taught him how to measure so that you'd get this side trim tall enough. The upshot of it is he finished the trim on one side, and just as he was about to shoot the nail gun, I was ready. He said, don't! And he shot it, and the nail went the wrong direction, came out the wood, and he was devastated. He said, oh, look what I've done. I said, don't worry, Alex. Everything can be fixed. And so I showed him how to fix the nail problem, and then he finished that side, and he was so excited that he got it done right. What tickled me so was when his dad came to visit, he called me, he says, could I bring my dad down and show him my door?
Oh, that's
and
great.
So he did, and so he had a board he wanted to cut for a shelf he was making to put his TV on. He said, be okay if I cut this board? I said, go for it. And so he stepped up to the power saw, and his dad's eyes got really big, like, this is my pre-dental son. You're having him cut that board? And so with great confidence, Alex stepped up and cut the board, and the father sort of breathed a sigh of relief. But
in what ways is teaching, you spent decades as teaching people how to teach, and it sounds like a lot of that is happening here in the store. In what ways is your career as a teacher and a trainer of teachers, how does that apply to the work you're doing now?
Every day it does, just like when we have one of the ladies that's downstairs right now, as a matter of fact, and she has an expression. I feel like, and no matter what her opinion is, it's like I feel like it's always coming from an emotion. I said, you know, I think I just need to suggest something to you. You try it on and see if you like it. I said, when you say I feel, and everything you're making a decision on is how I feel, what about thinking it through? Using your cognitive prowess. And so instead of always saying, I feel, think it through and then give a reason for why you feel that way. Don't just say, I feel it. But what's your rationale? What's your explanation for why you're feeling that way? And so we practiced. And and so she said, the reason why I feel this way is, you know, that's great. That's exactly what I'm trying to get you to do, to be a little bit more of an analytical thinker, so that you have, when somebody, even a professor, asks you to give a reason, a rationale for what you think or what you feel, you can do it, because you don't really go that way. You're much more of a feeling person, and that's good, but you have to support it.
How do you complement your natural bent with another way of thinking?
So there's those kinds of incidents happen quite frequently.
Yeah. There's a lot of grit and tenacity about you, if I may be so bold as to say.
I have heard that before.
Yeah, no, I mean, you could be sitting somewhere, you could just be watching your soaps, but you're 80 plus now, you're still going. Have you always been so driven, and what keeps you going?
Yes, I have. My dad used to call me bullheaded. My mother called me stubborn. And I, as I got older, preferred the words determined, tenacity, perseverance. I chose other words.
Yeah.
And that, although I couldn't read as a child, the teacher had all those years a little sign at the top of the chalkboard, and she said she told me what it said. It said, there is no such word as can't. And I say that every day to myself, there is no such word as can't. And so I'd think about that. And if you say you can't, then you're in trouble. Mm-hmm. So I really took that to heart. And then as an adolescent, somebody gave me a mustard seed in a little globe that I wore every day. And the faith, if you have faith as a grain of mustard seed, nothing shall be impossible unto you. And so I took that I took that to my mental bank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is that tenacity about you. I think the first time I walked in the store, because I just wanted to check it out, and you were wearing your cool rainbow Vans, just running around saying hi to everybody. And I was just amazed at the level of energy that you still have. And I think it's surprising to a lot of folks.
Apparently, I do hear that.
Yeah.
And some of the older people ask me how to get my energy. I'll tell you one thing that I think helps a lot is a positive attitude. Mm. And always trying to look and find whatever doesn't work, use it as a learning experience and say, well, why didn't it work? What do I do to make it work? Or if it's not going to work, what do I do instead of? And so I'm always looking for solutions. And so I think I grew up just being kind of a natural problem solver of natural practical things.
Right. I want to ask, forgive me if this question is a little bit intrusive, but you've mentioned you've had a very full life, and you've also dealt with your son's death, and you even mentioned just that you thought your home in Alexandria was going to be your dying home and making plans with your daughter. And I'm just wondering how you think about the life that you've had, the life that you will continue to have, and just how you even think about the end of life. I think that's a helpful discipline for anyone, but I'm just wondering for you, from where you sit and your wisdom and the life that you lived, how you think about, how you make sense of all that.
Oh, I just think you're going to die. That's all there is to that. You don't have an option. And I mean, I've had so many close calls with accidents. I've broken my back twice. I fell down those stairs and I fell off of a ladder and all these things. And I don't get very seriously hurt. Broken back is kind of a pain. But I just figure when it's time to die, you'll die. And that's all there is to it. You don't have a choice. And so live the happiest and the most fulfilling life you can live while you're able to do it. I would hate to clutter my mind with worries about dying. I think that when I get up in the morning, even when I don't feel well, I just stop and think, okay, what's in the cards for you today? Just get ready for it. Now, if you're feeling wretched right now, what are you going to do so that you feel good to do what you have to do today? And so I just talk to myself, and I just, I persuade myself to change my attitude. If a person really wants to dwell on having an ache or a pain, they'll just almost manufacture them, it seems to me. They don't know how to say, enough of you, pain. Get out of my life. I have stuff to do. It sort of reminds me of what Bryce said when the doctor told him, he says, I think it's time for you to go into hospice. My son says, I can't go into hospice. I have plans. And so that's sort of the attitude that I'm talking about. And when you go down and you go through the kitchen, you'll see some keys on the wall up above, 8 keys of excellence. And this last book that I wrote it with my friend Bobby DePorter, and it's on the 8 keys of excellence. It's how to live your life so that it's joyous, and how to live your life so that you're not only living a fulfilled life, but you're also helping others live a fulfilled life. And so where is the worry if you're doing that? You can't take your time to worry. Just move on.
Absolutely. Barbara Given, thank you so much. This has been a pleasure. I just appreciate hearing your story. You've lived a rich, full life.
Yeah, but I'm not ready to die.
You're not done. No.
You're not done.
I have plans.
Yeah, you got plans. You got to go downstairs and get back in the store. Right. So thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You can subscribe to the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Our theme is by No BS Brass. Chris Payne is our producer, but he's also the guy that doesn't judge you because there's trash on the floor of your car when you pick him up. Thanks for listening, and we'll leave you with this.
What do you do for fun? Do you ever rest, or are you just always doing something?
Life is fun. See, that's what I don't understand. I don't really know how to play in the usual sense of play. I just live life, and to me, that's the joy.